GoDaddy.com. Use the code BLU139 to get 10% off any combination of purchases at GoDaddy.com. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1378, July 19, 2010.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from someplace called Hog Mountain, Georgia. At least that's what my Garmin GPS, that's where it says I'm at. I spent the night last night over by, it was over in North Carolina. North Carolina. Along Interstate 85, not too far from, there's this Kings Mountain exit. I don't remember the name of the little town that the truck stop was near. So I've stopped there before. So in any case, stopped there, spent the night, didn't set my alarm clock, and I guess it was about noon Central Time when I woke up, and so I kind of got myself up and got around, and so in the meantime, the podcast listener, Joey, had knew I was on my way to the Atlanta area, and so he had sent me a message saying, hey, you know, if you've got time, I'd like to come out and, you know, meet you somewhere, have a meal with you. And so we ended up finding this Walmart. It's kind of, I'm northeast of Atlanta still a ways, outside of 285, along Interstate 85, this exit. It's, you know, there's a Walmart and a bunch of retail shopping type stuff. So I'm parked here at this Walmart. You know, there's this street with a cul-de-sac, and there was already a truck parked in here, so I parked my truck in here too. And then we went basically next door. There's a, you know, across the street, ways about a block from here, there's a Chili's, and so he took me to eat there, and so we ate, and then we had a nice long conversation afterwards. Really enjoy meeting people and you know, podcast listeners, and I usually end up having a lot in common and having really good conversations. Haven't been able to do that as much lately, you know, because I think primarily because I've been kind of stuck in the Northeast so much, and then on top of that, all of these, seems like a lot of the loads are sort of the overnight type of loads, and so there's no extra time to stop and see people, and, you know, and be able to eat with them and what have you. So but in any case, enjoyed that, and so came back to the truck, and then I've kind of been sitting here. I was on the phone for a bit, and then I've been on the computer, and I'm waiting to leave here. The delivery appointment is over. It's sort of, it's in Atlanta, but it's kind of southeast of town a ways. So it's basically over on the, you know, I'm clear over on the other side right now. I'm on the northeast side, and it's on the southwest side is where the load goes, and it delivers at 5 a.m. Eastern time. So I'm going to leave here so that I'll get there probably about 4:30 Eastern time. So that's not that far away. Right now it's about 1:22 a.m. Eastern Time. So then after that I'm going to go to the Marietta, Georgia terminal and see if I can't get the truck worked on. There's there's an engine problem that I talked about where if I give it too much fuel, particularly when I'm first taking off, if I give it too much fuel, then it'll start popping, and it's almost like the engine is missing, and then it smokes at the same time, and so if I back off of the fuel, usually it will quit, but the problem is getting worse and worse and worse, and there are some other more minor issues that kind of need taken care of, and so it's time to get it worked on. Because eventually it'll get bad enough where the thing won't run at all, and I don't want to get to that point, because I might be in a compromised situation, because there are a lot of times I'm constantly going through road construction where there might be just a single lane, or I might be on some bridge or some narrow two-lane road that doesn't have any shoulder to stop pull off on. So if the truck breaks down in a situation like that, it's really vulnerable, because it could be right out in the middle of the road blocking everything. So need to get this taken care of sooner rather than later, because as I say, the problem is kind of getting worse and worse as time goes on. And so I think this is a good opportunity to just bite the bullet and do that. I've got some feedback that Michael Moss sent me, and it's about 1:09. So I'm going to play that. So let's go ahead and listen to Michael. So here's Michael Moss.
Hello, Tom. Michael Moss here. Doing a good job here on the podcast. Been keeping up with you here lately. I've got a piece of feedback, kind of a short piece of feedback here, more of an opinion-based type feedback. Knowing with the success that you've had with your podcast and many others, do you think that we are moving into an age now with podcasting and with new media as a whole, to where more people will be apt to listen to your, and in this case also view your show, if your primary source is a video source and the audio, let's say, is like a companion or a bonus, if you will. I just wonder what you thought about that. I've noticed my video hits over time going up as well. I didn't know, maybe I know you've done videos in the past there as well, and still do from time to time. Didn't know what kind of hits you were getting on your videos, particularly in the YouTube sense. And speaking of that, of course, I am on YouTube. My username is Storm Moss, and of course, podcast at postacast.mevio.com. Looking forward to hearing from you, Tom.
All right. Well, thank you, Michael. Yes, the videos do seem to get more hits. Now, I really haven't had that great of luck with getting a lot of YouTube views. I think there are certain things you have if you're able to do on YouTube, you can really end up boosting the number of hits. That being said, if I put up a video, invariably it gets a lot more hits than the audio would. But now the problem with video is that audio is easier to do, and I'm kind of more motivated to do the audio. I personally, I think, get a lot more out of doing audio. Now, there are a number of podcasters that also, when they're doing their audio podcast, they sort of stream it live via YouTube, and then they end up Ustream. They stream it live via Ustream and kind of make a show out of it. And so there's a number of podcasts that are done that way. And I think that because of the increasing number of set-top boxes, Roku, and then the Boxy Box is coming out, and then there's something called Pop Box that's coming out. And also the smartphones are another place that people do seem to watch videos, although they're also consuming audio with those. So there is does seem to be a growing market or growing audience for people that are wanting to watch video through these, particularly I think through these set-top boxes. Of course, later this year, Google TV. They announced Google TV, and that's going to be some sort of a box, basically, that allows you. I think that's pretty much going to allow you to watch stuff on your regular TV through the internet, and it also somehow ties into cable or something. Now, I wasn't really sure on the details of that, and so that, you know, and I'm sure Google's got a couple of little things up their sleeve to try to. You know, it seems like Google is able to really come up with some innovative stuff that other people in different markets haven't been able to come up with. Although some of the Google stuff does flop. Google tries different things. Google Buzz, for example, kind of came along after the after Twitter, and Twitter became very popular, and Google Buzz, there just hasn't been, pardon the pun, much buzz about it. You hear people talk about it occasionally, but it's just, I don't know, it's there. If I happen to log into my Google account, the Gmail account, if I actually log onto the website, normally I just receive my Gmail through POP3, or, you know, I've got it on my phone as well. I think it's IMAP on the phone. But sometimes I actually log into the Gmail website, and Google Buzz is kind of, I think it's kind of integrated into that if you want to buzz something. But that was a case where it just didn't really, Google really didn't do much with that. And they've done some other things that kind of flopped, but on the other hand, they try a lot of different things. They're always experimenting with, that's one of the keys to their success. Is that they're experimenting with tons of different things, and some of those, a certain percentage of those things, end up being very innovative and really end up catching on. Certainly, Google has done well with Google, you know, with Android. Now, Joey, the podcast listener that I had dinner with earlier this evening, had what'd he have? He had an Droid Incredible, I think from Verizon. He's had it for 2 months. It has a lot of the features that my HTC Evo has. This is all. His phone was also manufactured by HTC. It's a Droid Incredible, and it looked like a really nice phone. You know, it gives you a lot, as I say, it gives you a lot of the functionality that I have with the HTC Evo. A little bit smaller screen, but a smaller device. And he was saying that he had an iPhone for, I guess, a number of years before that, before switching to the Droid Incredible, and he's very happy with the Droid Incredible. Google is really... You know, they've really made it, you know, they're really nipping at the heels of Apple, and they're, because of the Android operating system, and getting to the point where it's really a viable alternative to the iPhone, where, as I said, you know, I wrote that article on Geek News Central, I think we're really to the point now where... The smartphone is reaching critical mass. You know, the critical mass point being where, you know, it kind of moves into the mainstream. And millions and millions and millions of people are going to be around the world are going to be getting smartphones. And, you know, so it's with the set-top boxes and what have you, and audio and video being, you know, kind of moving to the internet, moving towards the internet as being a sort of a distribution vehicle, video, I think, is going to become more important. Now, you know, at the same time, people, I think there are plenty of people that are listening to podcasts. I don't know what the numbers are now overall, but I think podcasts, audio podcasts, are still, you know, there are probably more downloads, people downloading podcasts, than ever before. But it's kind of, I think it's kind of lost some of the, maybe some of the initial press that it was getting. You go back a few years ago and there was a period of time where it was getting tons and tons of press. So a lot of people know what a podcast is now, and there are people that are kind of casually listening. And there, you know, that's going to be probably more so as people get into smartphones, and then they kind of figure out what the smartphones can do and all the different apps. Joey showed me a number of told me about and showed me a number of different apps that he has downloaded, and I kind of showed him a couple that you know, on my phone that I'd ran into. And so, you know, it's people kind of, as people have these phones and they kind of compare notes, it becomes possible to basically by word of mouth or a friend showing another friend, it becomes possible for people to really find out what the cool apps are. And of course, you know, there's more apps that are being written every day. Now, a lot of them are junk, a lot of them are kind of useless, but there are always some that are interesting, and not every app applies to everybody. But I don't know. I think, video definitely, if you do a video, it's probably going to get more hits than audio will, just kind of depending. But again, the video part does take more. It takes more time to put together right, and you got to have your lighting right. That's one, you know, I could probably fairly easily, it'd take a little bit of extra effort, try to stream when I'm recording a podcast, but then the problem with that is that it's too dark in here. It's not easy for me to add light in the truck here, and so I've tried it before, and it's really not practical. But it's an interesting idea, and as I say, a number of podcasters are doing it, and I think they're, as you know, when they're able to kind of tie into these new set-top boxes, then it does kind of present a viable vehicle to kind of, you know, a new avenue to kind of get yourself out there. If you're a podcaster, you know, and you want to put some sort of video up, and then also there, you know, you can do that with record. You know, you make a recording of it and make that available as a podcast, and then, you know, people will consume it sort of after the fact, you know, the video version. So there is more opportunity, a growing opportunity for either for both streaming live video, as well as video that's already recorded, that's available, you know, that can be downloaded or viewed on demand or streamed on demand. So, you know, through these boxes, like those Western Digital boxes that I have at home that I've talked about in the past, they, you know, I can easily click, you know, go to podcasts or click on different things and begin streaming stuff basically on demand if I want to. So there, as I say, there, I think there is an opportunity for that. You know, I wrote an article and posted it last night on Geek News Central, and I was talking about the first three new, it was Podcast and New Media Expo. They kept changing the name of it. The first three that were held in Ontario, California, 2005, 2006, and 2007. And those were tremendously successful as far as social networking events, because, you know, podcasting is sort of a social media, and those were tremendously successful as social networking events because of where they were held at that Ontario Convention Center. Then you have this Marriott Hotel across the street, and everybody that was there. It was easy. They were easy to spot because of their badges for the convention, for the New Media Expo. And, you know, you had these people, you know, just meeting people constantly. And, you know, so it was a great social networking venue. But then the, you know, that went on for, and it kept, I think that it, I don't know about the numbers, but I think it from year to year, it was more and more successful as far as people hearing about it and deciding, you know, that maybe they didn't come to the first one, but they decided, hey, I'm going to make a point of going to the second one. And then they came to the third one, or, you know, maybe they only came to the third one. So Ontario was a very special thing, but, you know, it was tremendously successful as far as social networking, but of course, the promoters were trying from the very start to push the business aspect of podcasting. And, you know, I guess, of course, they had to make it, you know, they were doing it as a business and they had to make it work. And then they got the idea, well, we'll move it to the Las Vegas. So in 2008, they moved it to Las Vegas, and not as many podcasters showed up, and of course it was sort of lost in that Las Vegas Convention Center, which is just a, you know, it's a gigantic building. Of course, it's famous for, you know, they hold the CES there, the Consumer Electronics Show, every January, and so the place is gigantic, and that Podcast Media Expo was just kind of lost in there, and then plus you had, you know, so you didn't have nearly the opportunity to kind of run into people and start up conversations. And and then in 2009, it was part of Blog World, and then it really did kind of end up being a flop, I thought, because very, you know, there were some podcasters that showed up, but even fewer showed up in 2009. And the thing with Ontario, there were podcast listeners that were showing up as well. And that didn't happen, almost none of that happened in Las Vegas, with a couple of exceptions that just virtually didn't happen. It was more of a, that happened at Ontario. Had they been able to continue that at Ontario, I think from year to year it would became a, you know, it would have remained a major event, and it would probably have grown over, you know, from year to year. I believe that the potential was there for that to happen. And then perhaps the business aspect of it would have taken off eventually. But now, since it's part of this Blog World, you know, I don't think I'm going to go this year. I've kind of decided that I'm, you know, it's probably not worth going to this year. So we'll see. But so anyway, thank you, Michael, for your piece of audio there. Let's see here. Well, I'm going to go through the box office, the movie box office for this week. This was for the week starting July 16. So number one on the list is a new movie. It's been in release for 1 week. It's called Inception. It's in 3,792 theaters. The theater average take is $15,928. So far, it's grossed $60,400,000. And so here is the trailer for Inception.
What's the most resilient parasite? An idea. A single idea from the human mind can build cities. An idea can transform the world and rewrite all the rules. Which is why I have to steal it.
Never recreate from your memory. Always imagine new places.
He's hiding something, and we need to find out what that is.
We gotta break out of here. Give him the kick!
It was not a part of the plan!
Wake me up! Wake me up!
All right, so there was the trailer for Inception, and that actually looks quite good. I may go see that in a theater if I have the opportunity. That looks stunning and kind of mysterious. Almost Matrix-like. So in any case, let's go on. Number two on the list is Despicable Me. I've played the trailer for that before. It's been in release for 2 weeks. It's in 3,501 theaters. This week it took in $32,734,350. The average theater take was $9,350. Gross to date is $118,365,245. Number three on the list is a new movie. It's called The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Now that's interesting. It's only been in release 1 week, but they're saying that the this week it took in $17,373,000, but then it's saying gross to date was $24,461,000. So I don't know how they came up with that number, because it's only been in release just 1 week. It's in 3,504 theaters. The average theater take was $4,958. So here is the trailer for The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
I have been searching all over the world for you. You are going to be a force for good and a very important sorcerer. But for now, you're my apprentice.
I'm a what?
Are you insane?
I'm gonna give you the basics. If a sorcerer's weak,
his magic is weak.
Everything we do is to protect man.
I'm not a hero. I'm just a physics nerd.
So, let's go train. Weapon of choice, plasma bolt.
I got one.
And again.
How'd you do that?
I'm a sorcerer.
Well, that's new.
All that drivel about good versus evil. The world's about two things, power and control.
Great men have always been called. This is your calling.
No way. So we're supposed to save the world. Knuckle bump.
Might as well. Dave, you should run.
All right, so there's the trailer for The Sorcerer's Apprentice. And that actually looks kind of cool as well. Might go see that in a theater, possibly. So that one, definitely get that one on Blu-ray from Netflix anyway. But might go see that one in a theater if the opportunity should arise when I'm home next time. So number four on the list is the Twilight Saga Eclipse, and it's been in release for 3 weeks. This week it had a box office of $13,497,000. It's in 4,001 theaters. Theater average take was $3,373. Gross to date is $264,868,417, and that's, I guess, it is about vampires. It has the kind of the vampire look to the trailer. And, it doesn't interest me at all, really. Number five on the list is Toy Story 3. It had a weekend take of $11,742,000. It's been in release for 5 weeks. It's in 3,177 theaters. The theater average take was $3,695. Gross to date is $362,709,000. Number six on the list is Grown Ups. It had a weekend take of $10 million. It's been in release for 4 weeks. It's in 3,074 theaters. And the theater average take was $3,253. Gross to date is $129,254,000. Number seven on the list is The Last Airbender. It had a weekend take of $7,450,000. It's been in release for 3 weeks. It's in 2,805 theaters. The theater average take was $2,655. The gross to date is $114,833,000. Number eight on the list is Predators. It had a weekend take of $6,800,000. It's been in release for 2 weeks. It's in 2,669 theaters. The theater average take was $2,547. And the gross to date is $40,084,041. Number nine is Night and Day, K-N-I-G-H-T and Day. It had a weekend take of $3,700,000. It's been in release for 4 weeks. It's in 1,925 theaters. It had a weekend take, the theater average take was $1,922, with a gross to date of $69,209,379. And finally, number 10 on the list is The Karate Kid. It had a weekend theater take of $2,200,000. It's been in release for 6 weeks. Now it's in 1,532 theaters. The theater average take was $1,436. And it has a gross to date of $169,202,000. And so those were the top 10 most popular that are, you know, box office, you know, that are in the theaters right now. So anyway, I've got some email that's kind of collected, and so I don't want to sit on this too long, email and news stories. So we'll just jump right on into that. By the way, if you haven't signed up for Netflix, go to my website, truckertompodcast.com. There's if you look in the show notes, there's a little red Netflix banner. It's about this square. It's about the size of a postage stamp. And if you sign up for the free trial through that, I get a little money out of it. You know, and I'm not about, I just can't bring myself to ask people for money. I know a number of podcasts kind of beg for money. You know, they don't really, some of them really beg hard. Some of them are just saying, well, you know, if you like the podcast, donate, you know, or I don't know. I really can't bring myself to do that. I don't know. There's just something about that, you know, I don't know. I can sell somebody something if I believe in the Netflix service. I really like it. I use it myself. And I have no problem with selling something, but as you know, because you're getting value out of it. But I don't know, the idea of begging for money, you know. Now some things I understand, you know, that now, like, there's this one podcast that I listen to. It's called Audio or Radio Lab, and it's part of NPR. It's WNYC out of New York City, is where they make it, and it's on you know, public radio stations. And it's really a great, you know, it's a great show, and they make the podcast version, and they now what they've taken to do, and I can fully understand it. They've got a, you know, you can just text, they give you this it's just a little short thing, and they say, if you want to help us keep this free, you know, this podcast around, just, of course, it's a radio show as well, but if they, you know, and they're getting money from, obviously, from the government to continue it, but, you know, they also ask for donations, but you just text this number, and it, you know, from your phone, and it it sends them $10. And so that's kind of cool as far, you know, if you really want to support something that way, that's one way to do it, I guess. But, gosh, you know, the whole idea of just, you know, kind of asking people, please give me money, you know, that's, I don't know, I guess if I was desperate, I'd do that, but, geez, I don't know. So anyway, let's jump on into the email. This first one is from Simon. He says, just wanted to say I love your podcast. Keep up the really good work. And from one trucker to another, please stay safe. And that was from Simon. So thank you, Simon. Then Brent had sent this message, a little short message on Facebook. He says, your articles are enjoyable to read. Thumbs up. And he's talking about my Geek News Central articles. And so thank you, Brent. Then got this email here from Victor. Tom, I thought you might enjoy this. I thought it was pretty cool. Saturday, April 24th, 2010, over 30 members of the Opera Company of Philadelphia Chorus and principal cast members from the upcoming production of La Traviata converged on the Reading Terminal Market Italian Festival. Wearing street clothes and blending in with the crowd, the artist swung into action as the first orchestral strains of the famed were piped through the market, giving a rousing, surprising performance for hundreds of delighted onlookers who were there to enjoy the Italian delicacies and the everyday treats that the Reading Terminal Market has to offer. The four-minute piece drew an overwhelming crowd and won a thunderous ovation that included both the laughter and tears from the audience. And I had seen this. What I'll try to do is if I remember to do it, I'll embed the video into the show notes. But it really is kind of neat. You know, because they basically, you know, they knew this was going to happen, obviously, so they had video cameras there. And so you see this group of people, you know, just people kind of milling around, and you know, the opera singers are just kind of, you know, they're sort of pretending like they're just people. They're dressed in street clothes, and so they're just, you know, they're just people kind of milling around. Then the music starts. You know, they must have, they were playing it off of a CD or something. But it was obviously, it was loud enough where people were able to hear it. And then the singers started singing. You know, when it came time for them to sing, they just started singing. And so they showed a lot of the different people in the, you know, people's reactions to that. And most people were just, they were smiling and they really enjoyed it. And so that was really kind of a remarkable thing they did. So thank you, Victor. And then Ian had sent this link to a video. A Droid X sells out on the first day. And, you know, the various Androids, the Droid X came out. You know, of course, Joey had, you know, the Droid Incredible. All of the Android phones, you know, the ones that are coming out now seem to be really be popular. And that's what makes me think again that the smartphone really is now at critical mass. People are demanding, you know, there's a demand for these things, and they're really moving into the mainstream. And of course, that can happen pretty quickly because the average cell phone, this is the average, this is not, you know, this is the average cell phone lifespan is, you know, people keep them about 18 months. And so it won't take long at all. You know, the cell phone market moves very quickly. It's, you know, computer market kind of moves at a, you know, it's more of a mature market. It kind of moves at a snail's pace. But the cell phone market, because, you know, people are carrying around the devices, and the devices do kind of wear out over time, probably faster and people kind of get tired of them as well. So the cell phone market tends to move pretty quickly. Pretty interesting. Then Ian had also, so thank you, Ian. Ian had also sent this other article, or link to an article. Microsoft Windows Phone 7 is a disaster, tepid knockoff of a 2007-era iPhone. And so it was on Mac Daily News, but the full article's from InfoWorld, and I guess I'll go ahead and read it. It's kind of a lengthy article, and you'll kind of understand whoever, I guess it was Galen Grumman that wrote this. Windows Phone 7, don't bother with this disaster. Microsoft's demos of its great mobile hope shows Windows Phone 7 to be only a tepid knockoff of a 2007-era iPhone. There's no kind way to say it. Windows Phone 7 will be a failure. Announced to much bravado in February as the platform that would breathe life into Microsoft's mobile ambitions, Windows Phone 7 looked, based on very early previews, as if it might bring something new and exciting to the table. Back then, I noted that I was impressed by what I saw, with the caveat so far. No caveats now. Windows Phone 7 is a waste of time and money. It's a platform that no carrier, device maker, developer, or user should bother with. Microsoft should kill it before it ships and admit that it's out of the mobile game for good. It is supposed to ship around Christmas 2010, but anyone who gets one will prefer a lump of coal. I really mean that. Let's see here. Scroll down. The early demos were intriguing due to the use of the card metaphor to organize apps and information, providing a possible fluidity among apps and information that would let users swim through their business and social activities, and the distinct user interface, though based on the unsuccessful Zune media player, looked as if it would stand out from the crowd of mobile devices that have largely copied the iPhone user interface, such as Google Android, RIM's much touch-oriented BlackBerry Storm and Palm's WebOS. But that was just the lipstick. Now, in Microsoft's in-depth demo this week at the Mobile Beat conference, there's no mistaking the big pig behind the gloss. Seeing the user interface in action across several tasks, not just a highly controlled presentation, shows how awkward and unsophisticated it is. I had the same feeling you get when you got a movie based on a great trailer. He didn't write that quite right. Go to a movie based on a great trailer, only to discover that all the good stuff was in the trailer and the rest of the movie was a mess. A pig, in fact. And it's not just the user interface. Under the hood, Windows Phone 7 rests on creakingly old technology that the main competitors have all moved past. I was appalled, flummoxed, and stupefied by what I saw, and the answers to the questions from the 15 or so developers in the audience. Also, it should be noted that the minuscule attendance and the utter lack of passion in the room spoke volumes about Windows Phone 7's ultimate fate as well. By comparison, about five times as many people attended the session of WebOS. The bottom line is this: Windows Phone 7 is a pale imitation of the 2007-era iPhone. It's as if Microsoft decided in summer 2007 to copy the iPhone and has shut its developers in a bunker ever since, so they don't realize that several years have passed, that the iPhone has advanced, and that the competitors such as Google Android and Palm WebOS have also pushed the needle forward. Microsoft is stuck in 2007 with a smartphone OS whose feature checklist might match that era's iPhone, but whose fit and finish would look like a Pinto next to a Maserati. An awkward user interface that reveals Microsoft's history of clunky design. Let's start with that Zune-based user interface called Metro, as that is the first thing users will see. Now that I've seen it more in action, all I can say is how clunky it is. You will scroll and scroll to find out what you want, thanks to how Microsoft has oversimplified all tasks. Each tile has just a little bit of information, often just three items, and you're supposed to scroll sideways via finger gestures to see details on each option in full. Then click the one you want to get more details, but if you have more than a few apps in a tile, for example, this approach quickly gets too ungainly, hiding most options and requiring navigation down and up several layers of interface. It will be the gesture version of spinning your wheels. The developers at Mobile Beat quickly recognized the labor intensity of this UI method, and one asked the Microsoft rep if anyone had bothered to test it with users. The answer was essentially no, a scary thought indeed. Also, the big tiles quickly eat up screen real estate, about 4 feet, so you don't get the compact access to apps that all the other major mobile operating systems provide. I bet this will depress app sales for those poor souls unlucky enough to get seduced by the Microsoft brand or the inevitable discounts at the cellular stores as the carriers try to dump these devices in January 2010 for $25. Shades of the Unlimited Kin. K-I-N. Plus, Microsoft has done its usual trick of gumming up the user interface, even though this one is relatively simple. There are two ways to navigate through tiles, a panorama mode and in pivot mode. In both cases, the tile continues to the right and you swipe to see more. In panorama mode, cutoff text on the right indicates there's more at Mobile Beat. A developer asked if users knew what that cutoff text was for, and the Microsoft rep essentially admitted they didn't get it was a way to say more. In pivot mode, each tile is self-contained, and there's an icon to indicate there is more. It's a subtle difference. Using a panorama basically means the tile continues because it won't fit in a screen, while using a pivot means you'll have a series of what are essentially pages. I bet developers and users will get confused very fast. Visions of vistas, litter of control panel dialog boxes, Microsoft Bob, the Office ribbon, Clippy, and Windows 3 flew through my head. Not that Windows Phone 7 looks like any of these, it just shares the same flaw of being obtuse. Once you get past the basic user interface, the various apps that Microsoft is showing are not all that encouraging. They have little style and feel very basic. Microsoft has just released a beta SDK for its mobile Silverlight tool, so developers can only now start investigating Windows Phone 7's capabilities. As InfoWorld's Paul Krill has reported, developers seem tepid about the SDK too, although that might explain the lack of compelling examples from third parties. It doesn't explain the DOSness of the Microsoft Mail client, which reminded me so much of my green screen days on VAX. The maps also had a strong clunkiness to it, both visually, the overly thick borders on things, and operationally, panning and zooming caused a lot of awkward screen redraws. If the Windows Phone 7 flaws were confined to poor user interface, that wouldn't be a deal killer for many users. After all, most people run Windows whose user interface has rarely gained acclaim, but is generally serviceable once you get the hang of it. Inexcusably old technology limits Windows Phone 7. But under the hood, Windows Phone 7 gets worse. The core problem is its backward set of technologies, which will fundamentally limit IT developers and users alike. Here are some of the more egregious examples of Windows Phone 7 time warp. Its browser is Internet Explorer 7 with some IE8 compatibilities added. That means it does not support HTML5 as the iPhone, Android, WebOS, and Nokia Symbian all do. Didn't anyone on the Windows Phone 7 team know about IE9 and its embrace of HTML5? Why isn't Windows Phone 7 using IE9? It does not support multitasking except for Microsoft's own first-party apps, meaning the browser, email client, SMS client, and other such pre-installed applications. When you switch applications, they shut down, just like the iPhone did until iOS 4 was released this spring. Android and WebOS, of course, supported multitasking more than a year ago, and Google and Palm mercilessly attacked Apple for not supporting it as well. Yet Microsoft didn't build multitasking into Windows Phone 7 at the outset. This lack of multitasking also means there is no such concept as inter-application communication for third-party apps, not even for a primitive workaround such as the iPhone OS 3.2 Open-In feature. Thus, apps can't work together in WebOS, even though the user interface that Microsoft has shown off seems designed to do just that. The only thing that Windows Phone 7 will do is let third-party apps call first-party apps, so clicking a URL in a text message will launch the first-party, i.e. browser, to show the URL. Of course, doing so closes the app that had the text link in it. First-party apps can call other first-party apps, and these would all continue to run in parallel. It doesn't support copy and paste. Here again, Apple was a much criticized laggard, supporting the capability only in summer of 2009. Microsoft didn't have time to get this feature in for the first release, but we'll have it in a future version. Too bad there's not likely to be a future for it. And how could Microsoft not have copy and paste working in Windows Phone 7? After all, it had copy and paste in Windows Mobile 6.1, and before that, actually. No chance of a come-from-behind victory this time. Microsoft has not only just made an imperfect copy of an old iPhone, it has not kept up with the current mobile OS crop, nor moved ahead of any of them. I can't tell you how much Windows Phone 7 feels like the early 1990s Windows 3.1, a clunky attempt to copy that era's Apple System 7. In the case of Windows versus Mac, Microsoft kept plugging away and ultimately shipped Windows 95, which drew close enough to Apple's Mac OS to end the competition. The same thing happened with the Internet and the battle between Internet Explorer and Netscape, which the company first ignored and then made a successful mad scramble on. Microsoft has a long history of producing bad software and plugging away on it for a few versions, usually version 3, until it's serviceable. But that get-it-right in version 3 strategy won't work this time. Back in the Windows Mac battle, Microsoft had the bigger market share and was already entrenched thanks to DOS. In the key business market, PCs weren't all that personal yet. Macs were a niche product from the very beginning. Microsoft has the same establishment advantage in the early browser wars, but today Apple's iPhone is the top smartphone when it comes to data usage, such as via the web and apps, and Google Android is close on its heels. The iPhone is well established and entrenched, and Android is fast becoming so. Microsoft is nowhere, having essentially pulled out of the mobile market last year after spending a decade being stagnant during an era of cold peace against the equally stagnant BlackBerry OS. Microsoft has no establishment advantage in mobile today, so delivering an outdated, hamstrung mobile OS and hoping to fix it later just won't fly. I'm still shocked that Microsoft isn't showing any smarts or competitiveness behind its mobile OS. When the iPhone first came out, a wait-and-see attitude made sense, but more than 3 years later, it's crystal clear that the iPhone is no fluke and that it has, in fact, redefined the mobile market during this sea change. What has Microsoft done? It's wasted a couple of years screwing around with Windows Mobile 6.5. When everyone ignored that faux effort, Microsoft made a lot of noise around Windows Phone 7, yet also diverted resources to an array of mobile OSs, seemingly as insurance policies against Windows Phone 7 failure. Windows Phone 7 should have been Microsoft's Man on the Moon project, but now it's clear that the Windows Phone 7 was Redmond's equivalent of the bungled Hurricane Katrina response effort. If the iPhone is the platinum standard, Android is the gold standard, WebOS is the bronze standard, and Symbian and BlackBerry tie for 10, Windows Phone 7 is clay. A clay pigeon, in fact. Shades of the Vista debacle, it appears that Microsoft is content to deliver an obviously backward operating system for mobile users, or is so out of touch that it can't see the junk it's built. A larger problem that InfoWorld's editor-in-chief calls Microsoft's embarrassing problem with the future. Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer has made some angry noises at recent events about the need to get the mobile right with Windows Phone 7. I guess either he's not actually seen Windows Phone 7, or that there's no bite behind the bark. Microsoft needs to kill Windows Phone 7 and avoid further embarrassing itself by shipping this throwback. It's not a question of whether Windows Phone 7 will fail. It will. But how long it will take Microsoft to admit that failure? For the company's sake, the earlier it fesses up, the better. So anyway, thank you, Ian, for sending me the link to that. That was pretty good. And then Joey actually had sent a link to a little blog post here. Here's an article that sounds like some things you talked about on your show. How facts backfire. It's one of the great assumptions underlying modern democracy that an informed citizenry is preferable to an uninformed one. Whenever the people are well informed, they can be trusted with their own government, Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1789. This notion carried down through the years underlies everything from humble political pamphlets to presidential debates and the very notion of the free press. Mankind may be a crooked timber, as Kant put it, uniquely susceptible to ignorance and misinformation, but it's an article of faith that knowledge is the best remedy. If people are furnished with the facts, they will be clearer thinkers and better citizens. If they are ignorant, facts will enlighten them. If they are mistaken, facts will set them straight. In the end, truth will out, won't it? Maybe not. Recently, a few political scientists have begun to discover a human tendency deeply discouraging to anyone with faith in the power of information. It's this: facts don't necessarily have the power to change our minds, and quite the opposite. In a series of studies in 2005 and 2006, researchers at the University of Michigan found that when misinformed people, particularly political partisans, were exposed to the corrected facts in news stories, they rarely changed their minds. In fact, they often became even more strongly set in their beliefs. Facts, they found, were not curing misinformation like an underpowered antibiotic. Facts could actually make misinformation even stronger. Now, I don't agree with whoever wrote this, this guy. I don't agree with his conclusion. Now, I'd like to actually see the study, but the problem is not, you know, knowledge. There's this idea that knowledge can fix everything. And in fact, you go back to the Adam and Eve story, and the Garden of Eden, and, you know, what did they take? They took the bite out of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And, you know, if you look at human beings, and humanity, the history of humanity, the only thing that gets better is our knowledge. Our knowledge keeps getting better and better and better. Nothing else does. Human nature doesn't. The only thing that can improve human nature is, you know, if people being sincere, people wanting to sincerely, you know, to really be sincere and to kind of really be in touch with their common sense. Now, of course, that threatens a lot of people. And so, in other words, another way of saying this is, if, you know, you can have all of the facts in the world, but if people are separated from their common sense, in other words, if people are become immoral, is another way of putting it, because the two do go hand in hand. If you have too many people that are not genuine, that are brainwashed, I believe that 50% of the American population is brainwashed, and hopelessly brainwashed. They're externalized. They just respond. They look like normal people, but they just respond to the environment like animals. They're becoming more, you know, they're sort of devolving into animals instead of evolving into better human beings. They're going the wrong way. But so you expose facts to people like that, and it doesn't matter because they just respond to whatever the greatest pressure is. They're enslaved to their environment. They become enslaved to pressure. So, you know, I know there's this idea that people have that human beings are human beings and they're all kind of the same, and you know, we can just, you know, kind of study them scientifically and kind of study behavior and, excuse me, find out what works and find out what doesn't and so on and so forth. But that does not take into account morality. Science avoids morality like the plague because it suggests that there's a God. You know, there are people that believe that we're just completely programmed by our environment. You know, maybe a little bit by our genetics and, you know, by our environment. You know, kind of completely leave out the spiritual part, which, you know, that's the most important part. They leave that part out because that's how are you going to measure that? How are you going to see that? Now, I believe it can be measured. I believe that if they were willing to ask the right questions when they do experiments and when they're researching the brain and different things, that the spiritual part could be measured somehow. I think that it could, but because it really does affect our brains. I think there's no question about that. Everything that happens to us, and plus, in addition, our own attitude, and whether or not we're willing to look at ourselves, and whether or not we're willing to be honest with ourselves, really affects how our brains develop in a huge way. One of these Radio Lab podcasts I was kind of catching up on today while I was driving was it's the name of it's Deception, and you know, in it, the, you know, they talk to this woman that's basically she's like a, I think she was some kind of a psychologist, but she's also doing basically brain scans, and she found that people that are compulsive liars actually have more white matter than gray matter. And they're, you know, about 25% more white matter up in the front of their brain than they do have gray matter, which is, you know, kind of interesting. So I think that the white matter, the development of white matter, is just obviously it's a response to, you know, the people lying, you know, kind of being compulsive liars. And, of course, there's reasons why people are compulsive liars. But, you know, people are compulsive, but, you know, they can be compulsive with anything. So what they're missing, obviously, in this study is morality. You know, because you take morality out of the equation, you know, if you have a kind of a decline in morals, then the facts don't matter. People don't care. They're just brainwashed. The facts don't matter. So, you know, but there are people that think that, well, we can just regulate people and tell them what to do, and government will be the greatest pressure, and, you know, and we'll all just march in lockstep, and everybody will be alike. And sorry, I don't want to be a part of that world. So. But anyway, you know, if you got somebody and you can give them a fact and they just ignore it, you know, and it kind of depends on what, if, you know, the fact is, you know, I don't know, like, let's say you're arguing with a liberal and you're pointing at this debt, and then they'll go into this thing, Bush spent a lot of money, you know, and they go into this hate Bush thing, you know, and Obama, never mind that Obama spent, I forget how many times more than any other president has, you know, they'll start going, you know, into the hate Bush mode. And there's a number of other, you know, you can give them a number of other facts about Obama and what they're doing and so on and so forth, and they'll try to switch the subject. They won't acknowledge the facts. The facts don't matter. The facts literally don't matter. And that can work with conservatives, by the way. It can go the other way. If you have someone that's, you know, because you can have people on the very far right that won't look at themselves. And it's the same thing that, you know, in the end, you know, the devil, basically evil, doesn't care whether you're on the far left or the far right. It doesn't really matter. But right now, the far left is what's dangerous in our society. That's really where the big danger is. But the far, you know, that far right can be, you know, they can sometimes be dangerous as well. So, you know, there's all these people have tried to say Hitler was far right. He was far right wing. And it's actually the other way around. The way I look at it, Hitler was out there on the left, you know. So, but if people will twist things, you know, it's amazing how people can twist things so that they don't have to so they don't have to look at themselves. That's really what causes people to see things backwards, because they don't want to look at themselves. It's too painful, you know, for whatever. They hate the truth. There are people that just absolutely hate the truth, and they're dangerous. They really are dangerous. You know, especially when they vote. They'll vote your rights away. If there's too many of them, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, you're just... 666 is a percentage. You know, I think we're in America, we're about 50% right now of people being brainwashed. Permanently brainwashed. That's, you know, it's dangerous. Very dangerous situation we're in. So... anyway, probably better be cutting this off. It's 2:24 a.m. Eastern time. I'm going to see 3:24. So I'm going to get out of here probably in about, I don't know, I'll have to figure it out so that I get there. I want to get there probably about 4:30 Eastern time. And, so I get there about half an hour before the appointment time and kind of give myself a little bit of time to get there. So... anyhow, hope everyone had a great weekend. Hope you have a great week coming up. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.